Okay, so we'll return to a few earlier verses. Yesterday's class ended at verse number 2. So the thing was, there's this one king, his name is Ratitara, and he wasn't able to have children, so he commissioned Angira Muni to beget children in his wife's womb, and 7 children were born. So here's a continuation. Having been born from the womb of Ratitara's wife, all these sons were known as the dynasty of Ratitara. But because they were born from the semen of Angira, they were also known as the dynasty of Angira. Among all the progeny of Ratitara, these sons were the most prominent because, owing to their birth, they were considered brahmanas. Prabhupada gives a one-line purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur gives the meaning of Dvijataya as mixed caste, indicating a mixture of brahmana and kshatriya. So these sons were mixture. Verse number 4. The son of Manu was Ishvaku. When Manu was sneezing, Ishvaku was born from Manu's nostrils. King Ishvaku had 100 sons, of whom Vikuksi, Nimi, and Dandaka were the most prominent. It's a little hard to follow all this, I know, but hang in there. There's a small purport also here. According to Sridhar Swami, although the Bhagavatam had previously included Ishvaku among the 10 sons begotten by Manu in his wife Strada, this was a generalization. It was here specifically explained that Ishvaku was born from the sneezing of Manu. Haribo. Don't try it. It might be an easy way out, but it might have to perform many austerities to get to that level of, you know, conception. Okay. Of the 100 sons, 25 became kings in the western side of Aryavarta, a place between the Himalayas and the Vindhya mountains. Another 25 sons became kings in the castes east of Aryavarta, and the 3 principal sons became kings in the middle. The other sons became kings in various places. Text 6. During the month of January, February, and March, oblations offered to the forefathers are called Astaka Strada. The Strada ceremony is held during the dark fortnight of the month, when Maharaj Ishvaku was performing his oblations in the ceremony. He ordered his son Vikuksi to go immediately to the forest to bring some pure flesh. Okay, that takes us up to today's verse. So now Ishvaku he's performed a Shraddha ceremony. He's ordering his son to go to the forest and bring some flesh to offer to the forefathers. Okay, that's where we're at now. Thereafter, Ishvaku's son Vikuksi went to the forest and killed many animals suitable for being offered as oblations. But when fatigued and hungry, he became forgetful and ate a rabbit he had killed. So he blew the offering. He was supposed to bring it back, but he got hungry and he decided to have prasad before it was prasad. So here it is, he's being condemned. Purport. It is evident that kshatriyas kill animals in the forest because the flesh of animal was suitable to be offered at a particular type of yajna. Offering oblations to the forefathers in the ceremony known as strada is also a kind of yajna. In this yajna, flesh obtained from the forest by hunting could be offered. However, in the present age, Kali Yuga, this kind of offering is forbidden. Quoting from the Brahma Vaivarta Purana, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, Asvamedam galavabam sanyasam palapatrikam devarena sutopatim kolo pancha vivarjayet. Translation: in this age of Kali, five acts are forbidden: the offering of a horse in sacrifice, the offering of a cow in sacrifice, the acceptance of the order of sannyas, the offering of oblations of flesh to the forefathers, and a man begetting children in his brother's wife. So we heard about that. The word pala patrikam refers to an offering of flesh and oblations to the forefathers. Formerly such an offering was allowed, but in this age it is forbidden. In this age, Kali Yuga, everyone is expert in hunting animals, but most of the people are suitors, not kshatriyas. Haribo. Because you can fight doesn't mean you're a kshatriya. There's a lot of suitors, they like to fight also. According to Vedic injunctions, however, only kshatriyas are allowed to hunt, whereas sudras are allowed to eat flesh after offering goats or similar animals before the deity of goddess Kali or similar demigods. So these are insignificant animals that's mentioned here. On the whole, meat eating is not completely forbidden. A particular class of men is allowed to eat meat according to various circumstances and injunctions. So practically in every religious tradition you see that there is some concession for those who want to eat meat. And we see in many of the major religions, concessions have become the standard. Actually, all these religions or faith paths formally developed under the guise of, ahimsa. And that's true with all the major religions. But they always had an injunction for allowance for meat eating. But through time, that injunction became the standard. And then they allowed that to be, okay. But we understand it's simply an injunction that allows under certain circumstances. And the circumstances, we'll talk about that, are so rigid that when you actually go and perform these rigid rules, regulations, and restrictions, the idea is to discourage you because it's so difficult. But there is a class of persons who won't accept standard. So to allow them to maintain under the Vedic umbrella of activity, they stay within the Vedas. They're not deviant. They're not going outside and simply acting whimsically. They follow these injunctions, and they're allowed to eat meat. It's called mamsa. We'll talk about that. On the whole, meat eating is not completely forbidden. A particular class of men is allowed to meet according to various circumstances and injunctions. As far as eating beef is concerned, however, it is strictly prohibited to everyone. Thus, in Bhagavad Gita, Krishna personally speaks of Gauraksha, cow protection. Meat eaters, according to their different positions and the directions of the Shastras, are allowed to eat flesh, but never the flesh of cows. Cows must be given all protection. So there's a restriction that can never be altered. Om Agyan Timirandasya Gina Jana Salakaya Chaksu Unmilitam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Mano Vistam Stapditam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swam Padantikam Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasari Gaur Bhaktivrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So, here we go with restrictions. So this verse that's quoted by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu allows for kshatriyas, not anybody, but kshatriyas, those who actually have the caste of kshatriyas, who are qualified, they can go, they can hunt, and they can kill insignificant animals. Well, they kill animals. And those animals can be offered to the forefathers as part of the Shraddha ceremony. Shraddha ceremony is that ceremony where the son performs sacrifice in order to deliver the forefathers who may be stuck somewhere in the material energy. In other words, they may have reached the higher planets, or they may have only reached what we say, material levels of attainment, such as this earth or even lower. Sometimes they're in sinful activities, and therefore they go down, so the sons perform this ceremony according to Vedic injunctions. See, Vedic injunctions are meant to elevate people from one level to another. Therefore, there are so many forms of elevation which have so many principles, rules, and regulations. If you were to study them, you'd go nuts. Literally, I mean, it's so elaborate, so detailed, and so specific in how it's executed. Just like the way we do things has been given is concessionary based on Srila Prabhupada's understanding of the Western natures and training. But if we were to follow the Vedic principles for everything we do, especially our yajnas, we wouldn't be able to do it, because they're so exact that the chanting of the mantras and the quality of the performers and the time and the ingredients and the everything, there's so many considerations, have to be aligned perfectly in order to get the desired result, which is something of material benefit. As Krishna told Arjuna, Triguna Visaya Veda Nistriguna Bhavarjuna Nirdvandvo Nityasattvasto Nir Yoga Shema Atmavan. He says the Vedas, they deal with the modes, the three modes of material energy. Rise above these Vedas and engage in, be transcendental to these. Be free from all attachment and aversion and be situated in the self. Mm-hmm. So Krishna gave the injunction in the beginning of Bhagavad Gita that the Vedas are mostly materialistic principles that elevate from one material situation to a better one. That's all. So here, back to the point, is that, okay, there's a class of persons that want to eat me. So Prabhupada talks about this in many of his lectures. It's called mamsa. Mamsa. And what you have to do, this is just to show you what it means to want to have this desire. Alright, I want to follow God, but I can't give up my attachment from eating. Okay, here you go. So, you find a goat. It says, Prabhupada mentions the word insignificant animal. So, a goat is considered insignificant by Vedic standards. If you asked the goat, he probably would disagree, but anyway. But anyway, So, but cows, never. Okay, so goat is there. So then you go, you get the goat. Now you have to wait until there's a full moon, complete full moon. And you take the goat into a very secluded area, and you chant these mantras into the ear of the goat, or I think it's one of the ears, I'm not sure which one. And you're actually, initiating the goat. And you chant these mantras, and the mantras says, "My dear Mr. Goat, you are giving your life for me so I can eat you, and in a future life, I will also give my life for you so you can eat me." That's the mantra. Now, when you actually know the mantra, you lose your enthusiasm a little. Maybe a lot. So that's what the mantra says. It allows you. But then you're going to have to do the same thing. You're going to have to be in the position of Mr. Goat. Because you're going to go down because of this. And therefore, at one point, you're going to have to sacrifice your life in an upcoming birth. So Prabhupada says when we understand the mantras, we think, oh, better not, right? It's too much trouble. It's just suffering. Same with alcohol. There's also injunctions for people who want to drink alcohol. So there are some mantras and some, just like those who worship Goddess Kali. They offer meat, and they also offer strong liquors to Kali. Jai Sri Sri Radha Gokulananda Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman Gaur Nitai Ki Jai. Now, it's interesting. When Prabhupada says, the devotees were asking Prabhupada, when these Kali worshippers, when they kill these animals to offer this flesh to Kali. Now, Kali, she's an expansion of Shiva's wife, Parvati. She manifests herself in different forms, all the way into the fiercest form as Bajra Kali. Okay, now she can accept offerings. So the devotees ask, wow, Kali is, a wife of Shiva. Does she eat meat? Prabhupada said, no. Well, where's the offering go to? She has disciples who are witches and rakshasis, and they wait for her to get the offering, and she gives it to her followers like that. It's a pretty ghastly scene, if you think about it. But this is part of the Vedas. For those who want to, worship for material benedictions, they have to go through all this kind of rituals like that. So here we find one son of Isvaku. We hear about Isvaku, and Prabhupada mentions, it's mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita. He deviated. He went out to do his service to bring back flesh for the offerings. He got tired. He got hungry. He ate the offering. Sometimes we have that problem, right? Somebody steals the maha first before you get it. I remember in New Vrindavan, and we would never get prasadam in between meals. It was always on regulated times, and it was very austere. So devotees were stealing maha as much as they could, breaking into the maha cabinets. It was actually an epidemic of maha thievery that actually became planned. The brahmacharis would actually plot how to break into the maha cabinet. It was like calculated, just like when you want to fight an enemy, you have to put yourself in a good position and understand where the enemy is. So it was really calculated. But the problem was is that in the morning for breakfast, that was the main thing for devotees, because the rest of the meal was really austere. It was like plain rice and just dry oats like that. And it was maha. So if they would break into the maha cabinet, And therefore, the amount of maha would be reduced, and devotees would be really upset the next morning. So it was like treachery. So that we had to do something in order to stem this tide of maha thievery. So the community leader made a punishment. Anyone gets caught stealing maha, you have to get married. That was the punishment. For some, it maybe was not a punishment. Anyway, and it was good because the ladies, it took care of all the brahmacharinis. We didn't have too many brahmacharinis left after that. So they reduced the brahmacharini ashram like that. And it was one devotee, he purposely used to get caught so he could get married. Really, this is a true story. I'm not making this up. But then everyone understood his program, so when they would catch him, they wouldn't give him a wife, because that's what he wanted. So finally they figure out what to do with him. He's stealing money, he wants to get caught, he gets caught, So there was one Mataji nobody would marry. So that became his wife anyway. That's another story. I don't want to get into the details of that one, but... So anyway, no offense to the ladies. So this went on, and sometimes you get tired and you're hungry and you just eat the prasad before it's distributed. So this is what happened to here, this son of Ixtlahtlo Vicuixi, he broke the principles. And we'll go on to hear about what happened after that. And he got cursed. So back to this verse. This is an interesting verse. It's from the Brahma Vaivarta Purana, and it's quoted by Mahaprabhu himself, mentioning the five things in this age. So there's one injunction here that's also mentioned. It's forbidden to take sannyas in this age, right? That's what it says, right? And sometimes people quote this and attack our movement based on this verse. So what is it? Did Prabhupada break the standard? Did he go against the Vedic injunctions? Well, because there's two reasons. One is Mahaprabhu himself took sannyas at the age of 24, which was highly unusual. And he was also considered quite extraordinary as such a young, beautiful Brahmin who had everything material, good wife, a nice, loving mother. He was respected throughout Navadvip. He was a scholar. He had followers. He had wealth, prestige, everything. And he gave it up at 24. Usually you take sannyas when you go through the different vanashram, the different stages, brahmachari, grihastha, and then gradually moving away from the grihastha activities into a more lesser form of association, vanaprastha, and then ultimately sannyas. So Mahaprabhu did that. So Prabhupada would say, yes, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did. But what does this verse mean as far as a forbidden to take sannyas? It's talking about a particular type of sannyas. It's called karma sannyas. What is karma sannyas? You take sannyas, but you don't preach. You simply renounce, and you establish that order and follow the principles, but you don't preach. So that is forbidden in this age. That sannyas is meant for preaching or traveling and preaching. That's what this verse means. It took me years to figure this one out. And finally I came across some statements based on this. So this is the actual understanding. So we're following the principles, although it appears that we don't follow the principles. So these are some of the things. Now this particular verse here focuses mostly on meat eating and for concessionary meat eating. So Prabhupada says, when a devotee or one who gives up meat goes back to that type of activity, they fall to the lowest standard. He says, it seems like if you break the regulative principles, no one should break the regulative, but if you have some illicit sex or some intoxication, it's not so bad as meat eating. That's the way Prabhupada describes it. At least he says, when you go to a meeting, you become soddy. He said, that's very degrading, very degrading. Of course, all of them are sinful, but meat eating is considered to be abominable. That's how it's understood by the Vedic society. So because it actually causes, you know, harm, and you build up a lot of bad karma. You build up a lot of bad karma from eating meat. We understand that if someone is eating meat, it takes seven people who are connected with the killing of that particular animal that they get a reaction for the death of that animal. The person who kills it, the person who cuts it, the person who packages it, the person who ships it, the person who sells it, the person who buys it, and the person who eats it. All these persons are implicated in the killing of that animal. It's how strict the Vedic injunctions are towards, you know, unnecessary killing of animals. Why? Why is it so strict? Because Krishna doesn't see like we see. We see, oh, you know, there's humans and there's animals, there's bugs. But Krishna sees that each living entity is my part and parcel. and to cause discomfort or harm to any living entity is considered to be a form of violence. A form of violence. Just like one time, you know, one devotee was saying, Prabhupada, sometimes, you know, we find that there's cockroaches in the ashrams. Should we kill them? Prabhupada said, you should be killed. You can hear it on the tape. That's the way he said it, exact words. He said, you know, he said, because you are dirty, they're coming, and now you're going to kill. So one mistake leads to a greater mistake like that. So Prabhupada was pretty strong about this, about not causing any harm to any living entity. Prabhupada was sitting in his room one time, and there was one devotee with him, and it was quite a quiet. And Prabhupada was just looking in the middle of the floor. And then finally he called the devotee. He says, you see that? And the devotee couldn't see it. He said, well, Prabhupada said, there's a bug there. Get a flower, put him on the flower, and take him outside. Compassion of a great soul, seeing that not only that he didn't want to anyone to step on the bug, but he wanted to give that bug some mercy. So he said, take a flower and put him outside. This is the nature of a Vaishnav, that sometimes people ask us, should we kill mosquitoes? You hear that one, right? Yeah. Well, the injunctions in the Vedas say anyone that attacks with a deadly weapon, it's our right to kill. So there was one incident where, I believe it was Shruti Kirti tells this incident, that when Prabhupada was in Mayapur, and he was inside his mosquito net, and Shruti Kirti was giving him the evening massage before he took rest. And there was one mosquito inside the net also. And then Shruti Kirti mentioned, Prabhupada, there's a mosquito in here. Prabhupada said, never mind. Continue with the massage. And then the mosquito landed on Prabhupada, and Prabhupada said, now he's attacking. Now you can get him. So attacked with a deadly weapon, it is considered okay. But sometimes even devotees feel that that is too much like that. So that's a question of consciousness like that. But the principle is to try to avoid causing any difficulty to any living entity. You see the Jains, you know, they have that understanding. They wear the masks. It's a good principle, but it's not possible. You can't avoid, you know, when you do mortal and pestle, you're killing insects. When you breathe, you know, you're simply walking on the street. So what's the difference between a devotee and a non-devotee who both kill in that way, unknowingly? Prabhupada says, if one is engaged in devotional service, and because of circumstances, these living entities are killed, there's no reaction for that, because that person is engaged in devotional service. But those who don't engage in devotional service, imagine the karma they're building up. Just to come to this material world, you just build up so many sinful activities. We were hearing yesterday that verse from the 11th canto where it says that you come into the material world and you got debts. You're already a debtor. You have to pay to the forefathers, you have to pay to the ancestors, you have to pay to the sages, you have to pay to the demigods who are providing, and you have to pay to people in general. Everybody has to pay. If you don't take up devotional service, those debts increase. Just like his Prabhupada would use the example, all right, here's the light, but we have to pay the electrical bill. So the sun is giving, it's also light. So who's going to pay for the sun? So we don't pay by currency, we pay by sacrifice, yajna. So there's people who perform yajnas, but devotees who engage in devotional service, that verse ends by saying then they're, by engaging in devotional service, all the debts that one can accumulate and all the sinful activities that one commits unknowingly are automatically expunged or destroyed simply by the power of one's devotional service. But the devotee should also very be conscious not to do something sinful accidentally. Okay, so this is the, what we say, the precarious nature of this material world. It's so easy to, it's so difficult to avoid sinful activities unless one takes up devotional service seriously. Okay, any questions? Meat eating or anything related to it? Yeah.